take the opportunity to share the results or some of the fruits of the discussions that we have been having with the entire room. So if we could pay attention to people at individual tables in order, we'll have those tables spend a minute or two, not more, explaining how they furthered the work of the graduate student who presented earlier through discussion this afternoon. Olivia, if we could start with your table, please.
Okay, great. Hi, everybody. So as a refresher, we were talking about petroculture and the penetration of energy within society. So the sort of talking point questions that we came up with, that Olivia came up with, were in what ways do Canada's energy concerns derive from problems of habit, was the first question addressed. Secondly, how can plays and other art forms contribute to a better future? And thirdly, what do we make of the comment that any documentary about oil has to be a comedy? So addressing that first point, we talked a little about the idea of using green energy and how much it is ingrained as a part of our habit to say that Canada cannot be fully green. And I talked specifically, coming from my background in Hispanic studies, of the case of Costa Rica going 100% green energy, and this was widely publicized. And the first comments that you see on Facebook or amongst my friends were things like, well, Costa Rica is a small country, which is factually inaccurate, and that, well, it wouldn't work in Canada because this is the first response that you're seeing from people when this comes out, that, well, we can't do that here. And to what extent is that habit? And then, more recently, there was a publication indicating that Spain, large first world country, part of Europe, you know, has gone 47% green energy. And it's just, again, there's immediate backlash. And how much is this a simple habit rather than an actual addressing of the possibilities, the actual challenges to it? And these things become a habit rather than something that is open to discussion. So challenging habits was something that we thought is something that's really important, sort of not just saying that, well, this is this way, but questioning within our culture, why does the culture say that things are this way? Challenging the dominant paradigms with regards to green energy is a good example. And then we were discussing also the use of humor, and we have to sort of question the milieu that these debates are happening in films. When we look at these documentaries that are using humor, why are they using humor? Is it a technique to distance themselves from a serious argument? Is it something about having mass appeal? And we talked about the extent to which a lot of these documentaries are now appearing in wide forums like Netflix, and the accessibility of these documentaries, Netflix, YouTube, you can find them very easily. And if they're out there, why does change not happen, was sort of the direction that we were going in. And we talked about the idea of precariousness. And for the discussion of one of the films, the students were reading an article that described this idea of dominant affect within a culture, and the pre-war period being a period where the dominant affect was one of misery, misery of the working class. Post-war, we saw the discussion of boredom and the idea of having to alleviate boredom. And they then posited that our current situation is one of anxiety. But we have to be able to question that. Why is it a period now of anxiety? Is it because we have more things to be anxious about? Or is it because it's become such a media sensation, this idea of anxiety you should worry about? And it was something that entered into a lot of discussions here, is the idea that we're addressing so many questions as, you know, a controversy or something to worry about, rather than entering into a public debate and asking about how we can address it. We simply say, "Bah, climate change." So we were looking at the gap of the idea of articulating an issue to actually taking action on an issue. It's things like green energy. We even discussed a recent article that was challenging the idea that women over age 35 have a significant drop in fertility. There was a recent article that came out in Huffington Post that basically said this is all hokum. It's not based on good science. It's based on studies of women's fertility from 1680 to 1890, I believe. So even in terms of these constructions that we have that are supposedly based on science, we have to be able to question them. We have to learn to go beyond what the media is selling us, what the media is telling us about our culture, to actually go back to the culture itself to some extent.
That was an amazing sum up.
Thank you very much. If someone has a burning comment that they wish to add, we have time for maybe one, but otherwise we should then move on to the next table. And to be fair, that was an amazing summary, so you really need to have a... All right, let's move on. Blair, who's the reporter from your table? Great, if you could let us know.
Hi. So what was really... So this table discussed law and religion. Blair's very interesting question. And what was really interesting about this table was that Blair is Canadian, I'm Indian, and you're from Finland. And so we all had these different experiences of law and religion, our own personal experiences to bring to the table. And we eventually agreed that when you think about issues of law and religion, cultural factors have to be taken into account, and you cannot look at them in isolation. The question which Blair put to us, which you know he said was one of the main focuses of his thesis, and which I at least, and I think both of us find pretty challenging in trying to think about, is how would you conceptualize and understand the relationship between law and religion in a place, and how would that be beneficial to rethinking certain conflicts specific to that place? We did try to compare issues in India with issues in Canada and in Finland, looking at Canada and Finland as similar, as countries with a similar cultural religious ethos, and India as being completely different. And we did find some common points of comparison where Canada and Finland, for example, could gain from the Indian experience and vice versa. But to just sum up, and this is very brief, your question is really challenging, and it really requires a lot of thought, especially in the cultural context, and would also have to take into account people's behavioral psychology and conflicting psychologies of different communities of people, and sort of trying to place those psychologies within a common framework. In relation to your example of the case, would be maybe Canada's charter. Yeah. So.
Fantastic. Thank you. Again, the same, if there's someone who has a comment they would like to add to this, otherwise we'll move on. And I'm going to stop asking, so if you really have a comment, you need to raise your hand and aggressively say so after the next table talks. Amy, could you get the reporter from your table to... Thank you.
Hello? Okay. So our main answer, I guess, to the question, what knowledge will Canada need to thrive in an interconnected, evolving global landscape, is Indigenous knowledge. And so we had a really great question. We were only able to get to one. But Indigenous peoples are more actively taking part in discussions in global forums, such as Indigenous Peoples Global Summit on Climate Change. Their knowledges and experiences have been informing international policies on various environmental and social issues. What should be the role of Indigenous peoples in Canada? And how can we give more voice to Indigenous peoples in policy development and discussion? How can Canadian policies and government work together with Indigenous peoples so their knowledge and experience is valued and showcased in global forum? So one of the things we thought was definitely to involve Indigenous representatives in the whole decision-making process, not only as people giving advice in the beginning stages of any decision-making, but all the way through the process from collecting data and researching and advising and then actually be involved in the final decision-making, which is a huge important part that often they aren't included in. And then we thought making sure to include a diversity of voices within the Indigenous communities and making sure to get representatives from different communities, and then also through the communities themselves have a range of voices, make sure that a range of voices are heard. We wouldn't want the Canadian government to be involved with selecting who would be able to be involved, but leave that up to the communities. And we also spent a lot of the time, just because we weren't that informed, in learning about some of the ways that Indigenous peoples are included in policymaking. And it seems that there's a very, very different system in different provinces as far as how much Indigenous knowledge is incorporated into the curriculum, and that's something that maybe the provinces could learn from each other to some extent. Is there anything else? All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Burning, no. Carlos, if you could get the reporter from your table to speak to us about what you talked about MOOCs.
Where'd that come from? It's on? We had a stand up. Oh, yes. Okay. We had a rather wandering discussion, so I'm not sure that we answered your questions, but I'll tell you what we talked about. We first started speaking about the history of MOOCs here at McGill, and the first course being more content driven, a traditional packaged course where you have content and a series of multiple choice tests. It was a nutrition course, Carlos, if I'm right.
Chemistry, yes.
Chemistry, thank you. To the MOOC that Carlos is working on now with your team, I imagine, you're not doing this all alone, which is a much more constructivist approach where there is no formal curriculum, where there is no sort of prepackaged content, but where the participants are being facilitated to achieve their own goals in a very action-oriented approach to learning. So much more constructivist or connectivist in approach to knowledge creation and knowledge sharing within those local communities, responding at first to local concerns. From the first iteration of this course, Carlos's team has created a group of potential mentors or instructional coaches who could then be involved in future iterations of the course. So that rather than having one voice as a teacher, we now destabilize that power dynamic and have multiple leaders within the online space who can facilitate and respond better to the individual community needs. So I think what interested me in Carlos's presentation was the redefinition of the learning coming from pedagogical sciences. That what do we mean to learn something? What does it mean to learn? And how does the pedagogical practice shift when we move into an online space? So how do we redefine what a course is, and how do we redefine what it means to learn something when we move into an online space? In terms of research and in terms of McGill's role in this. So in terms of research, how do we gather data from these MOOC experiences in ways that move beyond traditional learning analytics? So how do we move beyond attendance, clicks, completion rates by statistical information to get deeper into some of the richer qualitative data when you're dealing with a massive course where you may have thousands of users? How do you mine that kind of participation for useful data when you're participating in a research project? How do you then represent that knowledge when you're reporting back to your funding agencies in terms of the community impact? If one of the things that we're challenged to do by our funding agencies is to say how we are having an impact on the community, how do you do that? How do you gather that data when you have inconsistent attendance, potentially, or when you have inconsistent completion rates in a MOOC? So, real challenges in gathering data and in showing what the impact of the work has been in working with MOOCs, but also, I think, great potential to be able to respond to specific needs within communities to real-world problems. And I really like that idea of bringing together theory and action in that sort of praxis, that space of praxis. It's fascinating. Sorry, I'm going to look back here at our scribe's notes, who's done a fascinating job, which I haven't had a chance to read, put on the spot. Group members, do you want to share the mic here? Did I get down the list? Did I do it? Okay.
All right, join me in thanking Tom.
Well, thank you.
May I ask a question?
A burning question.
My burning question. I think you can sit down now, Tom, but thank you. No, it's not for you. It's for your table. And I'm just curious to know whether part of your conversation was about the assessment and evaluation of learning in MOOCs. I don't know enough about MOOCs to know how that enters into the conversations, into the design, into the thinking about learning. Redefining, re-understanding how we think about learning. A part of learning is, of course, the evaluation assessment of learning. And so how do you manage that in a MOOC? In your MOOC? I have no idea, so I'm very curious to hear what you have to say. Stand up, please.
Because it was contrary to the philosophy that we wanted to do. So, is it good?
No, it's closer.
So we don't have an answer yet. Okay. We don't have an answer. What we are asking groups to do is to engage in social initiatives. They'd be groups of people either starting social movements or social enterprises or NGOs. So we don't want to see the assessment of the learning from a content perspective. We want to see the assessment of the learning from an impact in the real world perspective. So we want to ask them to tell us with their 7 sessions, and the 7th session has no content. It's what we call the learning party. So, and then everyone will share what happened in their MOOC. It could be content, or it could be a connection. It could be a new people that they met. How those things that happened inside of this MOOC had an impact in their real action.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Okay. Now the scribe from Greg's table, if you could avoid stalling and let us know what you discussed.
This will be, I think, fairly brief, and we also had a fairly meandering conversation. So it started off with some introductions around the table, and then Greg asked us, what role do values or self-identity play in processing difficult texts? And instead of answering that question, we started talking about how readers engage with texts, and what is a text, and what's the transaction between texts and readers, and what do you bring to the moment of engaging with a text? So we talked about some different theories and so on. And I believe Greg said at one point, or maybe it was our Dean Crisworth, who said that we're talking about texts as static and texts that can't respond. And we had a little discussion around how that seems to be shifting now in the age of digital literacy. People can comment on blogs, Wikipedia, people can change the content and so on. So I think that texts are perhaps less static than they used to be, and the interaction and the transaction with them are more, it's more of a, what's the word I'm looking for? Transaction, more of a transaction perhaps. What else did we talk about? We talked about how people come to believe certain things because of the ideological dispositions that they're exposed to. So there was the example of someone who watches Fox News every night might not necessarily associate themselves or position themselves as a right-wing person, but by nature of being exposed to these ideologies, you sort of come to believe things in a certain way, and that affects your lenses on how you're reading the world or reading difficult, controversial issues and topics. Do you want to add anything? Well, the one other maybe final point is that we discovered that as both people from the Faculty of Education, but two different departments, that we could maybe, there are some spaces where we could connect with each other a little bit more, because the work that Greg's doing is fascinating and wonderful, and I think that we should be pulling him into more of our teacher education, pre-service teacher programs, and that would be a really nice way to work from the bottom up and working with teachers. So that was, yeah.
Great, thank you. Go ahead, Francois.
we're gonna talk like that. I'm just curious about the Google algorithm. For example, you do a search. The search, more and more, there's AI, artificial intelligence are embedded in it. So the more you search, let's say about like traveling in Egypt, the less you see Arab Spring, for example. And so you get exposed to the more content you want to see. Like the search tend to please you. So how this get into the equation on literacy, is that a problem, or is that actually there's a way to configure that a better way to make better searches, or is it then a tool of danger on that?
No, I think that's a really interesting question. I've been told that the Google algorithms that, like, optimizes search results for you. It's good for things that you want to consume, like entertainment and other like items you can purchase, but not really great for learning. When you want to, like, because learning is a different beast altogether. You want to find different views. You want to find different aspects of this issue that may not be reinforcing the things you've searched for in the past. You want to see something new. You want to see something you haven't seen before. So I would probably distinguish between those two things. It's good for when you want to consume something, and something that's entertainment based, maybe less good if you want to learn something. But I say that I would think that with a sufficiently motivated person, they could find what they're looking for, and they can come around. That their algorithms are not strong enough to stop that from happening unless there's some kind of censorship going on. So I would say that with sufficient motivation, they could probably get around that. It kind of boils down to the question that these search results are optimized for things that supposedly are relevant. But I guess the question is, what is relevant then? When you have someone who has like a bias, is something that's relevant reinforcing that bias? Is that what we consider relevant, or is it something that's disconformity evidence, like people don't usually search for? Maybe that's more relevant for them to have.
Thank you. All right, I think let's have the reporter from Vanessa's table go next. Twice today she's jumped in like that. Go ahead, of course.
Hi, so as I had mentioned, I do have to go, so I will keep this brief as possible. So we did have quite a broad discussion, but I feel we've only scratched the surface of 3D printing technology. So we started with the question, how will your research lead towards the future for Canada? And we began our discussion looking at the economic impact of 3D printing. One of the big things that Francois foresees is an equalization between big urban centers and more remote areas. Also, there's the ability to try new things in response to a problem, in response to a crisis or an emergency, as he discussed during his presentation. In areas where employment is a problem, there's huge potential via this technology, and it adds potential to increase local economies. Then we discussed disruptive factors. So what happens to standard industries? And the example I used is that you can now use a 3D printer to create a lipstick. And as if you'll know, if you buy lipstick, it can be pretty expensive. So ditto with sunglasses. This is an industry where, actually, I didn't know this, but there was a cartel. So you don't need to pay $200 for sunglasses. 3D printing is something that could make these products way more accessible. So the pros are that you can innovate and create, and these industries will not be able possibly to maintain these inflated prices, or these cartels will not be able to sustain themselves. However, there are negatives there in terms of low quality materials, and regulation is a huge issue. So it's really impossible to regulate right now 3D printing at the grassroots level, which can be dangerous. For instance, if you wanted to make a car with a 3D printer and you don't know what you're doing, not only could you put yourself at risk, but you could be harming other people. So we really talked about where regulation can go in this industry. We talked about the potential for inventors. They will have easier access to patents and partnerships, and it's going to maybe lead to a creative society that has more tools and resources. We talked about what the future of 3D printing looks like. Are we heading towards a time soon when everyone will have a 3D printer in their homes? And the answer Francois felt is no. Although they are basically accessible, they're $1,000 and will likely become cheaper soon, the digital literacy is missing. So right now there's a gap because most people have no idea how to create a 3D model. So this is where things like Fab Lab and these other resources come in to act as a middle partner so that you can write to them and say, this is what I want to create using 3D printing, and they will do it for you. Or you can go to the Fab Lab and they're going to show you how to create what you want. So then we asked, is the Fab Lab a new economic model? And it could be. Certainly right now we looked at the fact that anyone who's online right now and wants to use 3D printing has the potential to be an entrepreneur creating a business with almost zero risk, because there's almost no capital investment there. So there is potential there. We looked at startup communities that enable designers to grow quickly internationally and can facilitate people who have limited resources. The takeaway was that now we're moving towards a more creative economy, and basically that everyone is born global now because of the internet and because of these new technologies. Did I miss anything? Okay. Burning question?
Yes.
Oh, you have one.
Hi. I have one. Question about potential loss of knowledge, because I liked how optimistic your talk was. But I'm wondering if it's true that not everybody is going to own a 3D printer, then does that become a political issue? Are we going to send a printer to this emerging economy to give them houses in times of crisis? Are we going to not send them? And if we do send them that for 10 years, then 10 years from now, knowledge about how to build those kind of emergency houses perhaps is not going to be there anymore. So does that come in your, does that come back in your research? Thanks.
Well, it's actually an interesting topic that when the first Fab Lab was founded by Neil Gershenfield, and he was at the head of the MIT Center for Bits and Atoms, and he wanted to build something that will actually be grassroots, that was be led by a community. And his better success was the Fab Lab in Kenya. What he wanted to do was not to empower rich, techie kids. It was basically to say, well, we're going to go and show that it's scalable. We can go in a different community and show that this technology is not that difficult. And that's why I say it's disruptive. It's getting easier to use and cheaper to have. So you, with like $5,000, you can build a whole lab in Nairobi, and suddenly you have people coming in. If you have people that are engaged in a community, they will learn. They will learn very fast, and they can use. And suddenly that example in 2005 was revealing that, yes, this model is working. And yes, we can empower other communities. But yes, there is a digital division. If you don't have the tools, well, you're really set apart. And if things are going more and more with this technology always have the two sides. So I think with the Fab Lab, there's an interesting model. Now we have to culturally, it has to be more culturally embedded in where we are imposing a technology. Because I think I'm a bit positivist in terms of technology, and you're right, there's always a downside of it. But I think the dialogue with the community is very important as the first thing. What do you want to build? You need the well. You need parts for that. We can do that. 3D printer now can self-reproduce themselves. You can print a 3D printer, so you can start to build a factory. And there's not all the parts, but now it's a 60. I think they have 63% of the parts are 3D printed. So yes, you need to have the plastic coming in. But what if you can print with sand, and you're printing somewhere in Mali? What if you're able to, because you have this discussion, it's really local at one point, but you have global resources. So I think that this local and global has to be sized in a way that it will empower people instead of marginalize them.
Thank you. All right, one last reporter from Vanessa's table.
All right, so I'll try to be brief because we're over time.
I'm sorry.
So the first thing we talked about is how unfortunate it is that important contributions of marginalized groups, such as Black jazz women in Montreal, in the case of Vanessa's research, how unfortunate it is that these contributions are not really being recognized in many official historical narratives. So in the future, we need to be thinking about how we can reconsider these narratives and be rewriting them so that we acknowledge these important contributions. And we should be using the arts, the humanities, and the social sciences as a way of recognizing and celebrating our differences rather than minimizing them. And by doing this, hopefully in the future, it will be harder to marginalize groups. So that's a very brief summary of all the things we talked about. Any burning questions?
All right then. So to wrap up today, Allison, when she was organizing, asked me if I would listen to all of the events today and then summarize them, which as I thought about it as I walked out of the room was really a daunting task after that meeting. And as I thought about it through the day today, it actually became clearer to me. At every single one of these tables, each of your presentations involved a demonstration that you were creating valuable knowledge. And then the discussions that happened at the tables and then the results we've heard from those discussions lean heavily towards the fact that we're looking at good ways to disseminate this knowledge. We have excellent pieces of knowledge that we can learn, whether they be about information about energy, information about religious or Aboriginal learning, information about historical information, MOOCs as a way to disseminate information, getting information and digital literacy online or through 3D printing. All of these things are information that we're looking at, and we realistically, in order to help Canada thrive in a way that we're looking for, we need to make sure that we can educate Canadians as well as we can. I don't know that I agree with Will Straw about how many PhDs should be accepted into a department, but definitely providing as much education to Canadians as we can. And if they cannot be fully educated on each of these subjects, then we at least need to provide them with the tools to critically determine or obtain a new knowledge at a time when they need to, so that then all of this knowledge that we are accumulating and working now at accumulating and will continue to accumulate can be accessed in a discernible and an intelligent and an analytical way by the Canadians who are going to use it, and by other people in the world who will then see it as valuable knowledge coming out of Canada. Anyways, I would like to close this conference by thanking all of the people who've been involved. So we have David Sincox and Holly, oh, her head just came up, from Skill Sets. From Graduate and Postdoctoral Studies, of course, we had Martin Kreisworth, who opened the conference. Carolyn Eastwood, Elizabeth Faure, and Elisa Pilkinen have all helped, as well as Mona for registration. And the fantastic Allison Crump managed to put all of this together for us. Finally, I would like to thank all of the speakers for the wonderful job you did today. So.